Good evening. Welcome to Infinite Consciousness. I'm Steve Anderson, filling in for Eva Herr, who is on the road this evening. And our guest tonight is Walter Starkey. Walter, are you there?
Yes, I sure am.
Well, good. I have been following Joel Goldsmith and his work for a couple of years, and I know you were intimately involved with him on many levels. And can you start off with telling a little bit about you and then your relationship with Joel Goldsmith?
Well, I was an officer in the Navy in the Second World War, and when I got out, I went straight to New York, and I felt about as full of holes as a sieve. And I felt that I had to find one central answer, that I couldn't plug it up with psychology or so forth. And I ended up getting a part in a play as an actor of John Van Druten's. And one day he gave me, I don't know how he got into a religious discussion, and he gave me some letters from a Christian Science practitioner. And he said, with your Methodist background, you won't understand these, but you read them and I'll explain them. Well, I took them home, and they were letters from Joel Goldsmith when he was still a Christian Science practitioner. And bells went off in my head, because this is the first time I had really heard that it's within you, that that presence is within you, and that's the truth of your being, etc. So he said, well, you better get in touch with him. So I began to do that. And then Joel left the Christian Science Church and began to write his own books. And so I traveled with him. I introduced him from the platform on his first talk in New York and on his first talk in London, and conducted all of his classes in New York and traveled with him. And so I owe the deepest debt of gratitude I could possibly owe to anybody to Joel, because he didn't project just the idea, but projected the consciousness. You know, Joel taught with the symbols of our Western Christian Hebrew religion, but he taught like an Oriental guru. It was more a transference of consciousness rather than words and ideas. And, you know, as far as that's concerned, when he was talking about consciousness way back, before quantum physics had come up with this modern version that says that everything that appears is consciousness manifesting in form, well, that's what Joel was basing his teachings on way back, you know, 60 years ago. So it was a remarkable experience. However, in the latter years, the last time I saw Joel, he gave a class in Chicago, and I was there, and we were alone, and he said, when are you going to teach the Infinite Way? That's the title of his teaching. And I said, Joel, I'll never teach the Infinite Way. I can't. Only you can. Mm-hmm. I can only teach my consciousness, whatever that is, but I will answer any call that comes. Well, there was a difference, because Joel, from that absolute background, said some words that I think if he was alive today, he would say differently. Very often in his writings, as you know, he would say, God is not in the human scene. Well, he didn't mean it wasn't right here. He just meant it wasn't in our interpretation of the human scene. But it doesn't come that way in the words. So in the letter books, we're spending more time talking about it in terms of consciousness, like quantum physics, manifesting in form, that everything we see is symbolic of the consciousness. The reality is the consciousness that has created it, maintains it, sustains it, and so forth. This is a little side trip I'm going to give you right now.
Okay, fine.
I wrote this book, Joel Goldsmith and I, and for 42 years, I kept my mouth shut about Joel, because Joel's teaching was very impersonal. He would share his own spiritual trip, but he wouldn't share his feelings as a man. And I respected that. So a half a dozen books that I wrote before this time I would always say that he was my main teacher, but I wouldn't discuss our relationship. And then this writer, author, minister, Catherine Ponder, had some tapes that I had made impromptu about some of my experiences with Joel. And so she called me up and said, "Walter, the time has come now. You've got to write a book and tell the world about the man, Joel Goldsmith." And for the first time in 42 years, he died now 43 years ago, and I thought, well, you know, maybe she's right. And then a really woo-woo kind of thing happened to me. About 5 days after Ponder called me, a man from Virginia who has taught hundreds of classes of Joel Goldsmith, always parroting Joel, not his own interpretation. Mm-hmm. And I'd only met him once before. And he called me up and he said he and his wife wanted to come to see me in San Antonio because they had something to tell me. And I thought, well, if they want to spend that money to come all this distance, okay. And so they came. And I went up to the room. Well, now, in my introduction to the Goldsmith book, I was totally honest through the whole book, except I cheated a little bit here, because I said their intuition told them. But the real story is that the woman said, now, look, you may not be into this kind of thing, and if you're not, that's understandable. We'll just get to know you and have a good time and so forth. But I channel Joel Goldsmith.
Oh, goodness. Wow.
And he has something he wants to tell you. Well, basically, I'm a little leery of a lot of psychic mm-hmm. stuff in this respect. Like all of us, a psychic can tune into a state of consciousness, but it depends on their own personal consciousness on how they interpret it
sure.
in form. But this was too much, so I said, well, okay. So she closed the curtains, and we started to meditate. And after a little while, in a slightly altered voice, her first words were, "Walter, I want you to write that book." Well, I almost fell off the chair, you know. So then I did write Joel Goldsmith and I.
Wonderful. I read the book a couple of months ago, and I've been listening to many of his tapes, his CDs, and have read a couple of his books. And he was a very private man. I know very little about him. And your book was such a delight to hear your journey with him and your personal spiritual growth with him, and more about Joel. Do you know why he stayed so private?
Well, Joel, a core belief in Joel's teaching, pardon me, was impersonalization. And he would say, impersonalize and nothingize. Take your eyes off the personal level. And so he kept everything as impersonal as he could.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't share, for instance, no one knows where he was buried. He wouldn't let pictures be taken of himself until right at the last year or so of his life, because he wanted to let the personal stay out of it. And there's one place where, you know, people have said to me sometimes, well, you've gone beyond Joel. And I said, no, you're absolutely wrong, because his mysticism is the finest that, you know, certainly of the 20th century, if not one of the finest ever. And but what I've done is I've expanded some things. And one of those is this. Joel would say, impersonalize so that you could take the power away from it. Nothingize it, he called it.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, yes, impersonalize, nothingize, and then repersonalize in the light of what you see. In other words, my friend out here, I mean, I can maybe find something wrong. I can go into the subjective nature of what this is, and then so that I can understand it. But then I have to now go and look at my friend again and see him in that light.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute. I'm going to start over again. 6 months before Joel died,
mm-hmm.
he had, if you've read Lorraine Sinclair's book,
I did, yes.
Spiritual Journey of Joel Goldsmith, right near the end of it, she has a letter that Joel wrote her from London, in which he said he was so alone he could not bear it.
Mm-hmm.
Tears were never far from his eyes. That he didn't know it was possible to be this unhappy and go on living. Well, he was with his wife and dozens of adoring students, but he was going through this dark night experience. And then he had the good grace to end that letter by saying, so I have another notch further to go.
Mm.
Then after that, he began to preach what he called living between two worlds. In other words, he acknowledged that we have two worlds. One is the objective, materialistic, third-dimensional world, and the other is the subjective, spiritual, fourth-dimensional world. And we live between those two. Well, my whole work in the books I've written, it's all God, the flowers and the fertilizer, and Gospel of Relativity, and so forth. They all are on one purpose. The time has come now when we have to do something that has never been done before. And I've studied the most of the world's major religions, and they all have this one difficulty. Without exception, they all have a supreme being, Allah, God, Brahm, whatever you want to call it. But they all say, you've got to get rid of your humanity. Lock it into a theology, put it into a monastery or a morality. That's your problem. And that creates the very dualism they say doesn't exist.
Yes.
Our humanity is here for a purpose. Rather than ignore it or try to say it doesn't exist, find out what it's there for. Actually, it's our school. This is what makes us learn. This is what pushes us to wake up. So it has a value. And so we've got to appreciate what it's telling us. You know, our purpose on Earth is to become conscious beings. So everything that happens to us, the good things and the bad things, are here for one purpose, and that is to make us conscious. Now, we can ignore it and not find out what they're telling us, or we can find out what it's telling us and move on. And, you know, what we have to realize that the human being part of us is never fulfilled until the final ascension.
Mm-hmm.
Even after the crucifixion, Jesus still had further to go. He said, touch me not, I've not yet ascended.
Right.
And so that's why, as long as we've got a body and we're manifesting with a personality, that means that this is our school and we have to use this. And what happens is, if we'll accept that and really honestly turn around and find out what a situation is telling us, we'll transmute it much quicker and much less painfully, and we call it a healing.
Yes. Yes. So how would you describe consciousness or higher consciousness?
Well, I'll describe it this way. We are like an iceberg. Only a tiny little bit of us shows above the surface. And we are really controlled by this great, massive unconscious or subconscious mind, which it does all kinds of things. It makes our heart beat, our food digest, all these things are going on. If we had to do them consciously, with a conscious awareness, we wouldn't have time to do anything else. So anyway, we have this little conscious mind. Now, its purpose is this. It can condition the unconscious mind. I mean, if we go over and over, God's the only power, God's the only power, sooner or later, that gets really implanted in our unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have to think it. We know it. But then, this iceberg is floating in the collective divine consciousness, or the collective consciousness. So you're an iceberg over there, and I'm an iceberg over there. And my consciousness is my total being. It's my aware mind, it's my subconscious mind, it's my divine mind. All of that together makes up my consciousness, you know?
Okay.
And so take away the consciousness, and the form ceases to exist, you know? And Teilhard de Chardin said that way back, you know, 60 years ago, and he said, there's even consciousness in a rock. it's a very dense form of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But a rock eventually will wear out, will be worn out, and so it won't be conscious anymore. It won't have consciousness. And so it's the same with our body. You take away the consciousness, and the worms will eat it. You know, it won't be living anymore.
Right.
So our consciousness maintains and sustains us. Now, I have what I call the metaphysical leap. And that's the point in life where the invisibles become more real to you than the visibles. I've often said in lectures, I don't see any people. Well, I really don't. What I see is a room full of states and stages of consciousness manifesting in forms. I have a terrible time trying to remember anybody's name.
Mm-hmm.
I remember their consciousness, which in the hippie days we'd say their vibration or their energy, indelibly. And all of us will say, you know, my first impression was right, and then I talked myself out of it. Well, our first impression is we pick up on the vibration. We pick up on the consciousness, and then we start intellectualizing and talk ourselves out of it. So everything is consciousness. And when you know that, it's wonderful. Because, say, for instance, if your body has a problem, a physical problem,
mm-hmm.
well, how can something heal itself? It can't. If you think you're your body, if you think you're what you're seeing in the mirror, you can't spiritually heal yourself. But if you know that is the form, and I'm going to change my consciousness, the form will change, and you'll call it a healing. You know?
Yeah, and we talked earlier today about, you know, that we do live in this world. We have this material body. We are in this human form, but we are not of this world. And I hear you talking about that, but how does one really experience that and get to that point of living that non-duality?
Well, first of all, you know, they say pray without ceasing. Well, one can't go around all day long mm-hmm. thinking prayers. But to me, the most important thing in the world to do for me is to meditate every morning. Now, if one has to get up at 7:30 in order to go to work, well, then get up at 7
mm-hmm.
and take that time. To me, that morning meditation is I'm taking a bath. I'm taking a psychic bath.
Mm-hmm.
I sit there and I have the luxury, and have for many years, I meditate a couple of hours every morning.
Wonderful.
And that's not just sitting there, you know, contemplating my navel.
Mm-hmm.
I read a little bit, I'll put it down, maybe read a little scriptures, read a little Joel, listen to a little tape or something. But I dedicate that couple of hours to this inner intent, because our intent is what's important. Otherwise, what we consider to be a god would be a monster, if a person had to know the right words and so forth. But what's important is our intent. So in the morning, I sit down with the intention of dropping all of my finite personal sense of self and getting to the point to where I can listen to my higher consciousness.
Mm.
I'm not listening to something that's flying around in the sky. It's my own divine higher consciousness. But I have to listen to it. As a matter of fact, I have to dialogue with it. If I, as a human being, have a problem, I'll talk to my higher consciousness, and then I'll get quiet and see what it answers me. And it will. And so that's the starting point. Now, to me, it's like music. If I get the music going, then I can leave the house and go to work, and I'm not consciously aware of it. But what happens, if you've ever been where there's music, you're not aware of it until
right.
it stops.
Until you listen.
And then when it stops, you say, "What's going on? Oh, the music stopped." And we can do that as spiritual beings. We can get our music going, and during the day when it stops, we can drop whatever we're doing and go, you know, in the restroom and slam the door or something and meditate and get the music going again. Now, when I was running, I had a resort conference center in Texas, outside of San Antonio,
mm-hmm.
and So it's quite a big deal. It's got a complete spa with mud wraps and all that stuff, and 250-foot swimming pool and tennis courts and things. And so when I was running it, which I'm not doing anymore, on the mornings when I didn't make my contacts, when I would go into the office, I wouldn't give anybody advice or I wouldn't make any decisions because I knew I wasn't coming from my higher self. Well, I didn't sweat it because I knew that later on in the day I'd get back in tune. You know, we're not at the same place all the time. We're a whole bunch of different people wrapped up in this one body. But there's something that's been on my mind a lot lately that a few years ago I wouldn't have thought about. But as I said, I'm now 87 years old, and I don't have an acre of pain, plenty of vitality, plenty of energy. I jog with my dog every day for a mile, or walk and jog for a mile, and so forth. Now, this is not just accidental. Joel Goldsmith used to have a flower by his meditation spot. That flower would represent the Spirit of God, you know, in the beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I burn a candle because that candle flame represents the Spirit to me. But if I take that candle outside, it blows out unless I have a shield around it. And then it won't blow out.
Okay.
So the shield is as important as the flame is, because if I don't have a shield, the flame will blow out. Now, our bodies are our holy temples, our shields. And so we have as much responsibility to take care of our bodies, to put the right food in them, and above all things, to exercise them and all, as we do to meditate. See, that's why I say the time has come when we have to do what's never been done before, close the gap between the spiritual and the material.
Do you see that happening today?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I don't mean to be getting into a political discussion when I say this, but the mess that we've gotten into now in the world has really, oddly enough, be a blessing, because it's so scary that a lot of people are waking up. A lot of people say, hey, what's important to me? What are my values? You see, in my days in the theater, I produced the play I Am a Camera that made a star of Julie Harris and was made into the musical Cabaret.
Mm-hmm.
I still get royalties from Cabaret.
Wonderful.
Anyway, and I was assistant director on the original King and I and those things. So I knew these sophisticated New Yorkers. Well, a lot of those, if I'd have 60 years ago tried to say the things we're talking about right now, they'd have looked at me like I was nuts and shrugged their shoulders and turned away. But today, it's different. Everybody is wanting to know. Everybody's waking up. And what's going to happen? Believe me, it's all going to turn out good in the end, because we are building a critical mass. And when that critical mass is strong enough, if 10 righteous men can save a city, 100,000 people who really know consciousness can save this bloody world. And we're going to do it.
Got it. Very good.
And programs like this add to it. That's building the collective consciousness.
Yes, yes, yes. Give me your definition of mysticism and the difference between mysticism and metaphysics.
Well, mysticism really is the doctrine of the belief that one can turn within themselves and experience that divine source. It's not, you know, my sister was married to a Methodist minister, and she, when I used that word, she thought it meant, you know, as I said, contemplating my navel or something. It's not that. We're all mystics when we turn within for guidance to our own instinctive selves and so forth. So that's what a mystic is, one who actually believes they can experience the presence of God in or as themselves. As is a key word.
Okay.
Whereas metaphysics really started out mind over matter.
Right.
We started out with how we use our thinking machine to bring these things happening. And I was looking at the New York Times today, the Sunday Times, and sure enough, The Secret is still at the top of the, the seller's list.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a catch in it, and a lot of the people have not recognized the catch in it. And that's this. Two of the people were motivational people. Two of the other people, Beckwith and what's her name, were coming from a spiritual standpoint.
Uh-huh.
And the difference was this. The motivational people used this energy of the mind to visualize what they want. For instance, if somebody wanted, you know, a pink Cadillac, they should get a picture of it, put it on the wall, and image the pink Cadillac, and they can use mental power to manifest that pink Cadillac. But then they may get in it, drive to a corner, and have a wreck and break their bloody neck because it hasn't come from a spiritual source. It's just come from the mental judgment of this is good, that's wrong. This would be good for me, that won't be. That limits it by a human being. Whereas the spiritual approach is, and you have to put energy into it too, is that I have a right. You know, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and Son, all that I have is thine. I have a right to perfect transportation. Now, I'm not going to outline what that's going to be objectively. See, one of them is objective. The other is subjective. I'm going to approach this subjectively. I have a right to have abundance, and I have a right to have perfect transportation or perfect partnership or whatever those things. And I have to put that energy out. I don't just sit back and have it handed to me on a plate, but I have to do it subjectively. For instance, there's a turnaround in our whole society right now, a complete turnaround, because up till now, the priority has not been the priority that Jesus gave us. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. Seek ye first a subjective approach. It has been, the results have been more important than how we got them. The bottom line has been more important. The effects have been more important than the cause. You know?
Yes.
They believe that the ends justify the means. This is the turnaround now. Anybody that believes that you can have peace by dropping bombs ought to have their minds rearranged.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you want peace, if you started with the subjective and said, I want to create peace, then what would you think of loving things to do? Build hospitals, build schools, feed the poor. Then you wouldn't have any terrorists.
Right.
But if you're going to take the objective approach of trying to kill them all, well, you're killing yourself. You know. So this is a most exciting, the most creative, and the most dangerous time we've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a book called The Third Appearance. And in The Third Appearance, I stay as much as I can away from scriptures and spiritual-sounding language, because that's not what this book is about. It's about consciousness and how consciousness has evolved in the 20th century and with the death of God, meaning the death of a God sitting on a cloud, and the Freudian importance of what's in your consciousness and how it all developed, leading up to today where the quantum physics are saying what they are about consciousness. And I was going to go someplace and I got myself sidetracked. But the other thing is this, that science has been proving God. Not how to, but what. We're finding out now how that quantum physics is a science. But the single most important scientific theorem that has not really been recognized was the Bose-Einstein condensate. Now, in 1924, Einstein and a man named Bose came up with this theory. He was never able to prove it, and he died feeling a failure because he hadn't been able to prove that theorem. And the scientists of that day said he was nuts, that this was crazy. But some young scientists in the 1990s proved it, technically proved it, and won the Nobel Prize for it. Now, the Bose-Einstein condensate says that though you cannot know a wave, which is made up of particles,
mm-hmm.
in the terms of a particle, or the particle in terms of the wave, which is to say you cannot know the infinite in terms of the finite, or the finite in terms of the infinite, at one point, they're the same. Now, this shows you why, for instance, the life and message of Jesus stayed alive for 2,000 years, because he was the Bose-Einstein condensate, where they said he was a God and a man.
Mm-hmm.
So the particle and the infinite, the finite and the infinite met in him. But that's the truth of all of us.
Yes.
We're all that. We are that point where the infinite and the finite come together. And we have to realize that. So what? In this book, I say it's very critical today, because out of our godliness, we have created a technology that can do incredible things. We've mapped the genome system. We can clone. We can do all these godly things, which in the past we would say only God could do, and we're doing them. But if we don't take responsibility consciously of being the presence of God, I'm not talking about any one of us individually, I'm talking about mankind as a whole,
mm-hmm.
we're going to destroy life as we know it on this planet. And this is what Gore is talking about with the melting of the ice caps and everything. We're doing it. And so we've got to wake up and take responsibility for our godliness. You know? Oh, it's a fascinating time to be alive.
And it's an inside job. It's the responsibility of every individual. And we can't depend on others to do it for us. We need to be doing it ourselves.
Sure.
Yep.
You know, you've heard the old analogy that a wave has all the elements of an ocean in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. A wave does. But we never say that the ocean needs the waves as much as the waves need the ocean. An ocean can't exist without the waves. Well, we are those individual waves that make up this ocean, this spiritual ocean. And we have to take responsibility for being a representative of that ocean.
Right. And I, the message that I really got out of The Secret and the Law of Attraction is to go into that meditative state, to go into that mystical process of listening to that still small voice and that infinite consciousness within me. And I know that the more that I work at it, the more I'm going to attract that in my consciousness and into my energy field. That was the gift of The Secret for me, was that what Joel was talking about was that the world depends on me, and I depend on me taking care of myself at a certain level. So,
right. But you see, what we're talking about is really come into the metaphysical field and the New Thought field in the last 10 or 15 years. 30 or 40 years ago, they didn't talk about the real responsibility the individual has. And you just said something that made me think, it's like any muscle you have.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to use it to strengthen it, you know, to make it strong. So we have to use this spiritual energy. Joel had a woman who studied his writing, and so she decided she was going to live by grace. She was actually a psychologist in doing prison work. So she resigned, and she went home to live by grace. She got to where she couldn't dust the furniture. And so Joel would have kicked her in the pants, because grace brings the opportunity to your doorstep, but then you got to do it.
Yes.
It's not going to just hand it to you on a platter.
Right. We live in this world, but we're not of this world. It just gets back to that again. One thing that I really don't see very much of in Joel's writings and in his lectures that I'm listening to is about all the healing work that he did. I know that he did lots of it. Can you describe any examples, any experiences that you saw him or heard about him? That
I wrote in my book that I had never gotten a physical healing from Joel.
Mm.
But shortly after I started studying with him, I stopped getting sick. And so that's the difference.
Right.
And I know that he had that reputation. And I would sit sometimes when I would visit him in Hawaii in his office and listen to him open and dictate 40, 50 letters a day.
Mm.
And as he opened them, money would rain out of them from people who thanked him for healings. But I'll tell you, if you really pin Joel down, he would say this. Remember, and I go back to Jesus and this, your faith hath made you whole. You know, he would talk about people who wrote him a letter asking for a healing, and they got healed even before the letter
right.
got to Joel.
Right.
So it wasn't anything Joel did. It's your faith. Now, we need Joel's with high consciousness and Jesus's with high consciousness
mm-hmm.
to reach out to, you know, to touch the hem of, so that we can heal ourselves. But the only person that you ever healed anybody is himself.
Yes.
And if you believe you are what you see in the mirror, then you're not going to be able to heal it.
Right.
If you know that what you see in the mirror is symbolic of your consciousness, and you can pray that that consciousness change, but you have to do it. There isn't any God sitting on the throne. Oh, every New Year's, I meditate to see more or less what I'm going to be talking about during this year.
Mm-hmm.
And last New Year's, it said, preach the gospel. Now, it doesn't mean Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It means the good news. But the good news is terrifying. It's really terrifying to the individual, because the good news says there is no outside influence in your life.
Yes.
Not a government, not a husband, wife, power, anything. That you don't give it that power. You are the total creator of your own life. There's no God sitting on the throne. The only God is that God within you, and you create the laws. Anybody that says, well, I always, that shows they put themselves under that law.
Mm-hmm.
Or I never, they put themselves under that law. We got to stand aside and take the responsibility of saying, if we don't like something in our lives, find out how we've created that law and put ourselves under it. And that's scary, because
yeah.
we'd love someone to blame.
Yes. And I have a couple questions about laws. So how about karmic law, and where does that fit in with spirituality?
Well, to me, it's still, yes, I know Jesus would say, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. That is basically Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically under law. Now, Jesus said, you cannot fulfill the law at the level of the law. Goldsmith said, you cannot solve a problem at the level of the problem. Same thing.
Okay.
Because those are objective. Now, but Jesus said, the purpose of the law is good. You just can't fulfill it. Except he did say, I have come to fulfill the law. How did he come to fulfill the law? By reducing, see, there's so many laws. There's an infinite number of laws. You couldn't possibly fulfill all of them. And our moralities are the laws of conduct we set up. We set them up because we're afraid we don't know how to live our lives, and we let a morality tell us what to do. But look at it. Every culture has a different morality.
Yes.
In the Muslim countries, it's immoral for a woman to let her face show in public. You know, and that sounds silly to us.
Right.
But each society has it. But Jesus gave us a one-word morality. It's the one word that stands for his whole message and separates him from the Old Testament. Love.
Mm-hmm.
If it's loving it's moral. We don't have to think, like today in our society, if I'm in business, I can bankrupt the man across the street and it's considered moral. Well, it's not in love, because he's my neighbor, he's my brother. And so in any decision you have to make in life, just ask yourself, what's the loving thing to do?
Yep.
And then you can't go wrong.
Right, and Jesus got it down to two laws, love God and love your neighbor.
Which means love cause, which is invisible, and love effect, which is visible.
Right.
And if you love both of those completely, you will see they are like unto each other.
They're one, yes.
I mean, and these things have been around for all these years, and it's just now really coming to life. I think that great teacher, Jesus, his message is just now really begun to be understood. We're just on the edge of it.
Well, don't you think that Joel really understood it? I mean,
I absolutely do.
Absolutely. It's just, it's so different than what you hear in the churches. But it just makes I so much resonate with the way Joel talks about the Gospels and what's there. It's just, and that...
You know, Joel didn't call himself a Christian.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And because of what that stands for in the minds of most people. But he was totally dedicated to the life and message of Jesus, the Christ consciousness.
Yes. But he also said that if he was totally dedicated to the Buddha, it would be the same message.
Yeah.
That it came from, you know, many different types of masters, but certainly his focus was on the Christ consciousness.
Well, let me tell you something, Steve. There wasn't a Buddha. There wasn't a Jesus.
Right.
There wasn't a Joel. There was consciousness constantly expressing itself. And when it came through a certain person, we say, oh, that was Buddha. And then as it grew and came through Jesus, we say, oh, that was Jesus. But it was that one consciousness that I am and you are the only consciousness.
Yes.
You know. And we just tune into different degrees of it. But Jesus always said, greater works shall ye do.
Yeah.
So this includes Joel. If we are where Joel was, left us when he died 44 years ago, then he was a failure. If we haven't added to it and taken it on and lived it and proved it.
Yes, I've always been puzzled by that quote of Jesus, because how can we do greater work than raising the dead to life?
Because we have looked at Jesus and glamorized him objectively because of the healing. I am quite convinced that if Jesus came back today, he would not perform the healings.
Mm.
And I'll tell you why. You know, he gave them the loaves and fish, and they chased him across, and they came to him, and he said, look, you don't want the miracle, the message. You want the loaves and fishes.
Yes.
And they said, well, try again. So then he said, all right, except you eat of my flesh and drink of my blood. Well, he wasn't a cannibal. He didn't mean it literally. His flesh is consciousness manifesting in form. His blood is the spirit that flows through us, that animates us. And they still didn't hear him. And then he made one statement that people have not paid any attention to. This is in John 6. He said, all right, I'm going to tell you the truth. Ye cannot come unto me except the Father bring you.
Mm-hmm.
And many of his disciples dropped back and followed him no more. We want to believe that if we study, read one more book, go to one more class, do one more thing, we're going to get it as though we can do it. No, we can't. It has to be our own spiritual evolution has to take us there.
Yes.
But if we open ourselves to that, it does take us there.
Yes.
It's really subtle, but we've got to stop looking at the world objectively in terms of the loaves and fishes and the healings and look at it purely as the transformation of spirit. And so Joel didn't do things that I ask him to do materially. I never ask him to do material things. But working with him, I became the youngest producer on Broadway to win the Drama Critics Circle. Everything I touched turned to gold. I've had a most incredible life.
Yes.
Because I've lived these principles that Joe projected into my consciousness. So I have a great debt of gratitude, despite the fact that I think a flaw is the absolutes that Joe taught. Because absolutes are deadly. Joe would say, once you get a touch of spirit, never again will such and such happen. Well, you have a spiritual experience, and then it does happen again, and you think, oh, that wasn't real. It was real. I mean, Joel's depression at the end of his life showed that with all of his absolutism, while he was still in body, it wasn't that absolute. So absolutes are wonderful to aim at, because you get further if you aim at absolute truth. But realize that we don't achieve it as a human being. So when we fall short, we can get up and dust ourselves off and not feel guilty and try again. Because if there is a devil, it's guilt. And any teaching that makes you feel guilty because you feel like, oh, I'm not living it, I'm not good enough, I miss it, I can't understand it, all that makes you feel guilty. And just say, the light's going to come to me, I'm going to understand this, it will be revealed.
Got it. Now, your language is just, I've heard a couple little differences in what I hear Joel talking about. So you talk about objectively and subjectively, and I don't remember Joel really talking in that form.
No, he didn't use those. It wasn't a popular language 40 years ago anyway.
Right, and he certainly didn't use any of the energetic language either. I mean, he didn't talk about intention and, you know, and the energy field or anything else. I mean, I just love listening to him because it's the language of the 50s.
Yeah.
And but he's saying the same. It's all being proven out, as you say, in the quantum physics now, and the science of it is
well,
we're saying the same thing.
Unity Magazine in September this month printed an article I wrote called "The Digital Generation." And the reason I wrote it was, I've been on the board at Unity for the last 6 years. I don't belong to Unity, but they asked me to be on the board. And they were complaining about, where are the young people? And the thing we have to realize, that these kids that have been brought up in the last 20, 30 years, their brains are wired differently than ours. I mean, the computers, cell phones, iPods are extensions of their body. I mean, and they're used to instant communication. You can't give them platitudes. You can't give them old-fashioned language. They just shut it right out. But if you talk to them about energy, consciousness, even divine consciousness, they'll say okay to that. So it's not their fault. It's our fault, our older generations, for not putting it into a new language that they can understand or appreciate. So we have to watch out, because I'm really anti-holiness.
What do you mean by that?
Huh?
What do you mean by that?
Well, people that go around being holy imply that not being holy is bad. It's all God. The Flowers and the Fertilizer, that's my most successful book. Because we have to know, we cannot say that God is omnipresent, but not there. That God is the only power, but there's this evil power over here. We've got to stop kidding ourselves. And so it isn't that those things are wrong. It's that we don't, we create the dualistic thing. We look out here and we judge this is bad, that's good. You know, Joel's whole teaching was going beyond bad and good.
Yes.
And you know, bad and good are not the problem. The problem is and. It's bad, good. They're like two sides of one coin. And there is no such thing as bad in this respect. Somebody will come along and see me cutting the trees down, and they'll say, oh, that bad man, he's cutting the trees down. they'll come back 2 months later and they'll say, what saint built that beautiful house? Well, you can't do any creative act which doesn't have what looks like an act of destruction,
right,
if you judge it. If I want to throw a pot, I have to rip the clay out of the ground. And so you might say I'm destroying the ground. But in our human, so we can't judge. We just got to know God's the only power, and though my human understanding, I can't understand what's going on. Oh, I know. I have a club, and Steve, I'd like for you to join my club.
I would love to.
All right, it's the TTP Club.
TTP Club.
Yeah. Trust the process.
Mm.
If there is a God, it's the divine process. And when things are disturbing or go bad, we just have to trust the process.
Mm-hmm.
And if we do, all the fancy metaphysics are unimportant. Just trust the process.
Yeah. One of my favorite sayings is letting go of the need to understand.
Yeah, because even that makes you feel guilty for not understanding.
Right. Because if I do think I understand it, well, the person next to me is going to understand it in a different way. You know?
Yeah.
It's all about the judgment. Where does gratitude fit in to all this?
Oh, mm-hmm. You just keep touching the right button. Because to me, before I get out of bed in the morning, I think of gratitude. That's the number one prayer. That's the only prayer we need. Because gratitude is the recognition of grace in your life. And if you want to know, to me, what is a spiritual teaching or not, there's a good test. If it doesn't have grace in it, it doesn't have anything that can set the laws aside.
Mm-hmm.
And gratitude is the answer to everything. We begin by having gratitude for material things, objective gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
Gratitude for a healthy body, gratitude for money in the bank, gratitude for a good job. But ultimately, gratitude that your name is written in heaven.
Mm.
And so when you wake up in the morning, if you can be grateful that your name is written in heaven, that you're being led to these truths, to experience them, to feel the presence of God, that's it. And of course, that's mysticism.
Yes. Yeah, my gratitude is expresses in yes, 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 or thank you, thank you, thank you. It's just and to be able to do that with every situation,
uh-huh,
everything that comes my way, if I have a strong attitude or opinion or a belief system, I know it's just that material human side of me. I actually heard a little beep here, so I think we're about ready to close. Any last words that you would like to say?
Well, no, I thank you for calling. And if you come my way, please look me up. And let's have a one-to-one chat.
I would love to do that. So you're San Antonio, right? Is that?
Yeah. Yep. And also, I have a website, which is Walter Starkey. That's spelled Starke. .net.
Mm-hmm.
www.walterstarkey.
Sure.
.com, I mean.
.com, okay.
.com.
So WalterStarkey.com.
Yeah, and it has everything on it.
Yeah.
It has, a monthly message and all kinds of stuff.